Welcome back to your Mike Malloy Show, your very special Mike Malloy Show. Brad Friedman in for Mike, who is out helping to occupy Washington, D.C. all for the rest of the week. You can get more information at OccupyWashingtonDC.org or October2011.org. He'll be emceeing the kickoff of the Occupy event out there in D.C. tomorrow. And we will be talking to many more occupiers later on in this show and for the rest of the week. As I've been spreading the word that we are going to be sitting in this week for Malloy, I've been trying to get the word out to the occupiers that third hour I am leaving open for you to call in at 877-520-1150. There's some dispute. It's either 115 or 150 or more than 200 different occupations around the country going on right now, beginning to grow, just starting out. I would love to hear from all of you guys tonight in the next hour. But before we get there, speaking of democracy, a week or so ago, I broke a story at Salon.com that kind of creeped even me out. Frankly, those of you folks out there who know me and my work at bradblog.com know that I have been working for years on election integrity issues. And by the way, I'm sorry, bradblog.com. We got a chat room there at bradblog.com, and you can tweet me at thebradblog. Okay, got that out of the way. Anyway, I have been reporting on election integrity issues, problems with electronic voting, the war on voting by Republicans who have passed these voter suppression laws all across the country. But as far as I'm concerned, this has never really been, to me, a right or left issue. This is an issue of right and wrong. And to that end, Joe Miller, remember Joe Miller, the Tea Partier up there, who ran for the U.S. Senate, the Republican, got the Republican nomination in, November of 2010 up in Alaska. Even he and I have common ground on this, as Joe Miller linked to my story at Salon on this. $26. Hell, you don't even need $26. For $10, $26, if you want to use the remote the radio frequency remote control, and little more than an eighth grade science lab education, you too can hack a Diebold voting machine without knowing anything about its source code. You can take over the entire machine. At least so says Dr. Roger Johnston, PhD, of the Vulnerability Assessment Team at Argonne National Laboratory. That's a division of the U.S. Department of Energy. I broke that story at Salon, included the video exclusively from the folks at Argonne. We're going to talk about that hack, what it means for 2012, and then maybe even some solutions, because Dr. Roger Johnston from Argonne Laboratory in Illinois joins me now. Hey, Roger, welcome to the Mike Malloy Show, sir.
Good evening.
Great to have you join me here. I've spent some months actually talking to you as you were developing this hack, as you were working things out. And I want to get to the specifics of how this thing works in a second. But just so people understand, once again, you don't live with your mom in her basement, as far as I know, and hack through the middle of the night. You're at Argonne National Laboratory. What does that lab and the vulnerability assessment team that you work with actually do when it's not hacking electronic voting machines?
Well, Argonne National Laboratory does quite a wide range of research and development, consulting, assistance for the government and for private companies. We in the vulnerability assessment team look at a wide range of issues associated with physical security devices, systems, and programs.
And, okay, so you're dealing with very serious issues. And before we get into how this hack actually works, one of the first things you told me was that you see this as a serious national security concern as far as how vulnerable these voting systems are to manipulation.
Yeah, I really think that election integrity is just a serious local issue. It's a serious national security issue. We really have a situation, I think, where, while it's not necessary to be a foreign power to be able to hijack elections, it certainly, I would think, might be tempting to foreign powers. But unfortunately, in general, I think our election security is not good enough even to worry about it at that level. We have to worry about, I think, individual hackers.
How does this hack that you developed work, and how is it different, really, from any other similar type of hack? Because, you know, I've been covering this for years. I reported on the Princeton virus hack of a Diebold voting system, where they were able to insert code into the machine that would flip votes on a Diebold touchscreen electronic voting system in such a way that it would flip elections. It could pass itself from machine to machine. We've seen other hacks like that. Yours kind of comes at this issue from a different angle. Explain that.
Well, my colleague John Warner and I, who work on a variety of different security-type devices, were vaguely paying attention to the work that had been done looking at the security of electronic voting machines. And we realized that a lot of the people, the majority, looking at the security issues were computer scientists or cyber hackers. And while we certainly agreed that many of the attacks that they had demonstrated were probably viable and of great concern, we kind of got the idea that perhaps it's a situation where when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. These people were attacking these voting machines by going after the smarts of the machine, the computer or the microprocessor. And while some of these cyber attacks were pretty easy, a lot of them required a fair amount of sophistication. And we got to thinking that there's probably simpler ways. In particular, it's not often necessary really to fully understand what's going on the smart end of the machine if you can fiddle with the data or the communication stream elsewhere in the device.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's essentially the type of attack that we wanted to look at. The type we chose was what's called a man-in-the-middle attack. It's a little bit of a misnomer. It's actually a microprocessor in the middle. But it's a pretty simple idea. We're going to essentially interfere with the data coming from the voter going into the smarts of the machine, so that if the voter votes for our candidate, fine, we'll leave that data flow alone. But if the voter votes for somebody we don't like, we'll flip that vote and basically tell the microprocessor or the computer incorrect data about what the voter wanted.
And now you're able to do this without having any knowledge of the source code of the voting system. And I should say, we've talked about Diebold touchscreen system here, but you also did a similar hack with the Sequoia touchscreen system, specifically the Sequoia AVC Advantage, the one that's used all across New Jersey for the most part. So you knew nothing about the source code. None of that knowledge was necessary because you're inserting a physical chip, right? A piece, you call it a piece of alien electronics, sort of between the voter and the motherboard of the computer?
Yes, that's correct. Actually, the Sequoia Advantage AVC isn't exactly a touchscreen. It's more kind of a push-button machine, but it's basically a similar idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in either case, we basically don't worry too much about what's going on inside the microprocessor or the computer. We're just feeding the computer bad data. So it's the old story of garbage in, garbage out. We don't really care what the smarts of the machine is doing if we're basically fooling it as to what the voter wanted.
In essence, your chip is the only thing it needs to know is what is the incoming signal, and is that the signal that it wants to pass to allow to go through essentially to the voting machine? Am I understanding that correct?
Yeah, basically in the case of a touchscreen, it's a two-dimensional coordinate on the touchscreen that represents the candidate of interest. So we just essentially send the wrong coordinate information.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of the Diebold, we only had to do this one way. In the case of the Sequoia, we had to do a man in the middle in both directions. We had to tell bad data to the computer, and then the response of the computer that lights up certain lights to tell the voter that his or her candidate was chosen, we had to tamper with that data too. So the Sequoia was a little more complicated in being a two-way man in the middle, mm-hmm. whereas the D-Bolt, because of the way the voting is done, only needed to be one-way, although we could have done it two-way.
So if it took a little more than an eighth-grade science lab education, as your colleague John Warner says in the video for the D-Bolt, maybe then it's a ninth or tenth-grade education to hack the Sequoia? Is that all we're talking about as far as the difference goes? In this?
Well, actually, the Sequoia was a lot easier if you don't worry about covering up your tracks, if you're not concerned about the machine permanently having the data wrong. But if you want to basically cover your tracks, so in effect you turn the cheating off mm-hmm. after Election Day, then the Sequoia is a little more complicated.
I got gotcha.
It kind of depends on what you're trying to accomplish.
Did this take you – actually, you know what? Let me take a quick break here. We're going to come back with Dr. Roger Johnston of Argonne National Laboratory, the vulnerability assessment team who hacked – and you know what? And if you see this video, we've got it at bradblog.com. It's had about 30,000 views over just the last few days since I broke the story at Salon. They just take the entire touchscreen machine open over by remote control from up to half a mile away. Much more on that straight ahead. You're listening to Brad on The Mike Malloy Show.
Day in November, I took that stroll to cast my ballot at the local poll. The lines were long, but I didn't care. I had water, a hat, and my folding chair. Walked up to the booth, didn't say a word. Sure that my voice would be heard. I hit that button, my vote was sent. But now nobody knows exactly where it went. They lost my vote, it isn't fair. Stand. Doesn't anybody care? They lost my vote. Now do you know where did my ballot go?
Lost? Lost your vote? Or was it stolen by a bad guy with $26, a radio frequency remote control, who could take control of the machine and make it vote any way they wanted to? That's what Dr. Roger Johnston argues can happen, demonstrates can happen in a video tape that we broke last week. My story at salon.com on this and at bradblog.com. Dr. Roger Johnston of the Vulnerability Assessment Team at Argonne National Laboratories joins us to explain how this works and what we can do about it. And, by the way, if you have any questions, we would love to hear from you. The phone numbers here are 877-520-1150. That's 877-520-1150. If you have a question about this remarkable and frankly, a chilling hack. And by the way, tomorrow, since I always talk about the problems with these electronic voting systems, tomorrow we're going to be talking about some solutions in the form of hand-counted paper ballots. Nancy Toby of New Hampshire will be joining us to talk about her book, Hands-On Elections, counted by... Hey, let me give you the full title here. Now I can't find it. Now that I need it, I can't find it. Anyway, it's Hands-On Elections, counted by, you know, real people, stuff like that. We'll be talking about that tomorrow with Nancy Toby. Okay, Dr. Johnston, so you were able to take over this system. How long did it take you to figure out what you needed to do? Of course, if anybody does it now, it'll be easier because they can watch your video. But how long did it take you to figure out how to take control of this D-Bolt electronic voting machine?
Well, in the case of the Sequoia, we had it figured out in about 2 hours. Now, this is without an owner's manual or a circuit diagram. In the case of the D-Bolt, being a little more complicated machine, it took around 25 man-hours. before we understood enough of what was going on to begin figuring out how we would tamper with it.
And so this was two different, touchscreen, direct recording electronic devices is what we call them. In the case of Diebold, it's a touchscreen. The Sequoia one that you were able to remotely hack was a push button. But it's not just touchscreens. These are used in about 20 to 30% of the country. They will be used again next year in the presidential election. But as you and I discussed last week, it's not just touchscreens that are vulnerable to this sort of manipulation. This same thing could theoretically happen with paper ballot op-scan devices as well, correct?
We believe that these type of man-in-the-middle attacks are potentially viable for all kinds of different types of electronic voting machines, certainly potentially for an optical scan. Although I do have to say, if I had the choice of general design of an electronic voting machine, I would go with the optical scan. And I don't think they're currently very secure, but I believe it'd be possible to build in a fairly good security in that type of design. I think it's a much tougher problem on a touch screen or a touch button type of machine.
So this is something that it's not even necessarily a matter of building these systems better when you're talking about touch screen type voting machines, DREs, as we call them, direct recording electronic. Could they make it better, or is it smarter at this point just to ditch that and use paper ballots?
Well, I mean, I think that's a question that I'm not really qualified to answer.
I mean, on a security level,
right.
When it comes to DREs, can they even be protected?
Yes, I think they can. We're facing some serious challenges here. The machines themselves are not designed, in my view, with very much thought given to security. But more seriously, the way that they're typically used by election officials and election judges really isn't very optimal for good security. There's many fairly modest changes one could do that would potentially substantially improve the security of these machines, but it really involves having a healthy security culture and being able to think about the security issues, really thinking like the bad guys.
And it also doesn't get around the threat from election insiders who, it seems to me, are the greatest threat to these systems. We're going to talk about this more. We're speaking with Dr. Roger Johnson of Argonne National Labs. Give us a call, 877-520-1150. If you have a question, 877-520-1150. Brad in for Malloy.
What is love? And the evidence is clear. I'm not alone.
No, you won't. You guess I keep it going. Keep it going. We will be fighting for your vote. Whether you want to vote or not, if you vote, I think we should count it. I think we should count it accurately. And by the way, if you want to vote and you are of age, I think you should be allowed to vote. What do you think about that? Even if you don't have a car and a driver's license. Brad Friedman in for Mike Malloy as the occupation begins. We are occupying your public airwaves tonight as Mike is down in D.C. More on that in a bit and in the next hour when we will be taking calls from occupiers around the nation at 877-520-1150. If you'd like to call us now concerning Dr. Roger Johnston, who's my guest here for the moment, from Argonne National Laboratory's Vulnerability Assessment Team, he is the one, along with his colleague John Warner, who were able to hack a touchscreen voting machine. In a few hours' time, really, once they figured out how to do it, didn't need to know the source code. All they had to do was place a $10 chip into the machine, and they were able to take complete control over the touchscreen system, the type of systems that are used in some 30% of the country, even now, even though we know all of this about them. And for another $15, you can add a remote control, and you can take complete control of a touchscreen voting system from a half a mile away. He also says the similar type of hack could happen with an optical scan machine. I'm going to get back to him in one moment, but I wanted to give the correct title for Nancy Toby's book. She'll be joining me tomorrow. Tonight we're talking about the problem. Tomorrow we'll talk about the solution. Her book is called Hands-On Elections, an informational handbook for running real elections using real paper ballots counted by real people. Imagine that. We'll be talking about that tomorrow. But now we've got Roger Johnston here. And before we went to the break, Dr. Johnston, we were talking about insiders. And you had said that you felt these machines could be made more secure. But is there anything that can guard against an insider basically changing numbers, flipping the results of an election from the inside if they have access to these systems, as most election officials and a lot of voting machine company officials have?
Well, I think the insider threat's a serious problem in any security application, not just involving elections. It certainly is typically the greatest threat, whether you're talking nuclear safeguards or cargo security or whatever. There are mitigating countermeasures to deal with the insider threat. Few organizations use these or use them very well. Mm-hmm. There's some obvious things such as doing background checks. In the case of voting machines, randomly selecting some to be pulled out of the election process and then at least partially disassembled and examined for signs of tampering or alien electronics or software malware.
Let me actually, you mentioned two things there. One, you said, is background checks on the people who use these systems, for example?
Yeah, my understanding is most election municipalities or precincts really don't do background checks on, for example, the people who transport the voting machines to the polling place mm-hmm. and then back to the warehouse after the election. Many cases, there's not much in the way of background checks on the actual technicians who work on the voting machines, program them or prepare them for the elections. If you've got someone with serious drug or financial problems or a known criminal background, this might be a matter of considerable concern.
Well, here's the problem, and I don't know how much, if you saw any of my coverage over this of this at bradblog.com. Are you familiar with what happened in Clay County, Kentucky, Dr. Johnston?
Just vaguely, yeah.
Yeah. In that case, about eight different election officials, the highest ranking election officials in Clay County, Kentucky, were found to have been gaming elections for years down there, most recently on ES&S iVotronic machines, simply changing the votes of voters after they left the booth. And this was the county clerk of Clay County, Kentucky, the circuit court judge down there, the school superintendent down there. These were folks, election judges, who were specifically doing this. They were all in on this scheme. These were the high-ranking election officials. And these are the folks, and the reason I point this out is because you said, background checks. Well, I would think the circuit court judge and the county clerk would pass that test.
You'd hope so.
You would hope. But here they were gaming the system. And I don't think anything guards against that, nor do I think anything guards against the concern that they may have done it, whether they did it or not. In other words, you understand, we will never really know if they did it or not when we use these type of systems.
Well, a general rule in security is it's always about people in the end. It's not really about technology. It's not really about security strategies. It's really about people. There are countermeasures to the insider threat. Mm-hmm. Background checks aren't the only possible approach, but they're not a bad start. You really need to have, again, a good security culture in thinking about what insiders might potentially do. There are ways that one can actually reduce the insider threat. Driving it to zero is a very difficult problem. But I think the real problem with elections is we don't do much of anything about the insider threat. And that's really the problem. We may not totally be able to solve the problem, but we need to be taking some countermeasures.
And it's just not the case with these electronic voting systems. As we have learned over the years, they all use, at least in the case of Diebold, they all use the same type of key, a mini bar, quite literally a mini bar key that you can get at Staples. They all use the same key to open up these systems, but you found that you don't even necessarily have to open up the system in order to perform your remote control hack, correct?
Yeah, we demonstrate in the video where one can go in from essentially openings that are already available that wouldn't have a lock or a seal. It has to be a little bit of a contortionist, but you can insert the alien electronics without actually ever opening up the voting machine per se.
I'm going to get to your calls in a moment at 877-520-1150 for Dr. Roger Johnston of the Argonne National Laboratories Laboratory. But is there any reason? I know you study a lot of very complex security issues, but when we're dealing with elections, is there really any reason that you can see that we need to use computers like this, given how important these elections are, and given, frankly, how easy it is to game the system without getting detected here?
Well, it's kind of a value judgment. Security is always a trade-off. If you want the absolute best security, you're not going to be very happy with it. It's going to be expensive and totally burdensome. On the other hand, if you don't have any security, then you're wide open to attacks. Where that exact line is, what the threshold is, and where we want to be, that's a value judgment that the public and officials need to decide. As a vulnerability assessor, I can talk about the vulnerabilities of different kinds of approaches. Mm-hmm. I can suggest ways to improve security. But in the end, do we need to go to paper ballots? Are we still okay with electronic voting machines if we did a better job with them? That's a value judgment, for the American people to make.
Do you, when you look at security issues, as I mentioned, we're going to have Nancy Toby on here tomorrow to talk about counting paper ballots on election night at the precinct in front of everybody, before with results posted before those ballots move anywhere. Do you assess systems like that or only computer systems? In other words, could you look at a hand-counted paper ballot system and say, okay, this is actually more secure than a computer?
Well, we actually look at a lot of paper record security issues for a wide variety of different applications. Certainly protecting paper in some ways is a more straightforward kind of security problem. I think you can have good security with paper ballots. I think you could have good security with electronic voting machines. The question is, how comfortable are you going to be with the security measures that are needed in each case?
Yeah, and I'm not sure I agree. Let me go to Chris in Oakland, California. And by the way, I think I might have accidentally hung up on somebody there. Call back 877-520-1150. Chris in Oakland, California. Welcome to the Mike Malloy Show. Do you have a question for Dr. Roger Johnston?
Well, a question and a comment.
Okay.
Thanks for taking my call. You were talking about initially, just in the last couple of moments in this last segment, you guys mentioned that you don't necessarily have to open the machine. So I called in before that. But my point was, if you do need access to the physical manipulative access to the internals of this machine, why can't they just put a lock on the thing? State regulators have put seals on every gas pump, and I live in California, a lot of gas pumps. There's a seal and a crest and a signature on every gas pump to certify that it's accurate. I don't know why they don't just do this and put a lock on the thing that the state commissioner, regulator, whoever, puts their seal on it, and that's that.
Yeah, let me get an answer from the doctor. What do you think, Roger? Is that a solution? Seals?
No, unfortunately, it really isn't. We do a great deal of work with tamper-indicating seals. And while if used properly with a great deal of training and careful approaches, one can begin to have a fairly reliable ability to detect tampering. But this involves far more training and understanding of tamper detection than we see typically from election officials and technicians and poll judges. Tamper-indicating seals in particular are awkward when they're pressure-sensitive adhesive label seals, like the kind that you're talking about. Those in general do not provide good, effective tamper detection. They can be defeated by amateurs with just a little bit of effort. So, unfortunately, it'd be nice if seals were really the answer, but at least the way they're currently designed and the way they're currently used, particularly for elections, there's very little effective security there.
Yeah, and it also seems to me, when it comes to elections, when you're using those seals, a great way to really suppress the vote at a precinct is just violate the seals that they use on each of the voting machines, and then, in theory, nobody can vote because the seals have been broken, and then what do you do? Chris, did that answer your question?
Yeah, pretty much. I wasn't necessarily talking about like a pressure-sensitive adhesive kind, maybe some other kind. But if it's looked into and not feasible, then there's only one other alternative. But I think some Democrats have to win majority, like by 90%, somewhere in Georgia before there's a political will to fix this problem.
Yeah, of course, the entire state of Georgia uses the very same touchscreen voting systems made by Diebold that Roger Johnson hacked in his video that you can see at Salon.com and Bradblog.com. Chris, thanks for the call. I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let me, 877-520-1150 is our number. If you have a question about any of this, next hour, we're going to go back to the occupation. It's all about democracy, people. Are you beginning to get that? Let me go to, actually, I think I should go to a break here. Come back with more of your calls, 877-520-1150. Give us a call right now. Get in line. And if you're an occupier anywhere in this nation, anywhere in this country, you can call us as well and get in line for the next hour. Speaking with Dr. Roger Johnston of Argonne National Laboratories, the man who was able to take over a Diebold voting machine for $26 and control your vote. Sorry. Brad Friedman in for Mike Malloy. Much more straight ahead. Please stay with us. They are, or if they may be, you don't know. We can't know. Brad Friedman in for Mike Malloy, speaking with Dr. Roger Johnston for just a few more minutes here about his alarming, chilling, disturbing hack of an electronic, several electronic voting systems. You can read about it in my story at Salon.com from last week or over at Bradblog.com. I am, of course, in for Mike Malloy, and we will take your calls next hour on The Occupation at 877-520-1150. But we got a couple of folks who have some questions or thoughts here for Dr. Johnston. And I should add, by the way, that these machines, these touchscreen machines, will be used by almost 30% of the electorate or so in the 2012 presidential election cycle. Everyone else will use electronic systems for the most part, optical scan systems that can also be gamed. Although tomorrow we'll be speaking with Nancy Toby from New Hampshire, where she counts paper ballots by hand in front of the people. All right, let me go to Arnold in Durham, North Carolina. Welcome, Arnold, to the Mike Malloy Show. What's on your mind, brother?
Hey, Brad, how you doing, man? Great, great show you have tonight on this subject matter. It's very good because we are overlooking a lot of this, and we're just going to fall into a trap with this. You know, as a young teenager, 1965, I watched at the Pettus Bridge as Bull Connors, the elite guard, crashed into the right flank of all those protesters up there, mm-hmm. and just started swinging clubs and beating the heads of people who were there to get the right to vote.
Yep.
Just to be realized here in the year 2011 and going to be in 2012. 2012, that the vote is just is meaningless. The attack on democracy is far worse than what those guys did to people out there by beating them in the head.
Arnold, I completely agree with you, and I don't want to cut you off here, but we're coming up at the top of the hour, and I want to get a question for Dr. Johnson. You can call back next hour on that. Do you have a quick question for Dr. Johnson on this?
Last year, did they use these same machines in the 2010 election?
Yep, they sure as heck did. And Arnold, let me get to another call here. Give us a call back in the next hour or later on this week. You're absolutely right on your points, but I want to hit something here for specifically for the doctor. Carla in Marin County, California, welcome to the Mike Malloy Show. Do you have something, a question for Dr. Johnston?
Yeah, I want to know how hard it would be to train a whole bunch of progressives to hack the damn machines. I mean, if you can't, the Republicans are Republicons, as Norman Goldman calls them. They're sociopaths.
Let me. I know. I hear you're opining there, but let me get an answer to your actual question. Is it difficult, Dr. Roger Johnson, to hack these machines by whether it's progressives, Republicans, Iran, China, Anonymous? How difficult is this?
Well, I don't think you really need an army of people to do it. You need maybe one. Some other attacks might more conveniently be done with more people. But I think currently it doesn't represent a major challenge to someone sufficiently dedicated and willing to risk getting caught. I think it's just not that hard.
Which is what I try to tell everyone all the time when they say, oh, this is a conspiracy theory. And I say, well, it's not a theory because we've seen these hacks actually done. And it doesn't take a conspiracy when one insider, one properly placed hacker, can change the entire result of an entire election. Dr. Johnson, I really appreciate the work that you've been doing on this. Do you plan? You've done the Sequoia. You've done the Diebold. Are you going to continue along these lines with other voting machines as well?
Well, we'd like to. There's just not, unfortunately, much funding in this area on election security. So we kind of have to do it as Saturday afternoon projects, which makes it very slow going. But hopefully we'll get a chance to look at some other issues.
Yeah, well, because no funding, because elections, they're really not all that important, apparently, in this country. Unbelievable. I'll try to get you a few more machines. And by the way, that machine, that Diebold machine, was donated by to Argonne for this test by VelvetRevolution.us. VelvetRevolution.us, which was co-founded by the Brad blog, by way of full disclosure. Roger, thank you, sir. Really appreciate your work and talking to us tonight once again about this subject.
My pleasure. Thanks, Brad.
Have a good night, Dr. Roger Johnson of Argonne National Laboratories. Your occupation calls coming up next, 877-520-1150. Your public airwaves, use them or lose them more than you already have. Brad in for Mike Malloy. Call us.